My name is Tom O'Connell, and we're talking about Robert Frost's poetry dealing with humor, and it's picking up from where we left off yesterday, where we were also talking about his humorous poetry. You folks going to be able to see from back there okay? Let's see, we got another seat right here.
Before you go any farther, will you do something for me?
Yeah. Yes, I need to do something for you. Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, how can you hear me all right? You can read me all right?
I turned up a little bit.
Okay.
I don't want to miss what you say.
I appreciate you not wanting to miss a word. I think they can adjust it in the tape ministry. How's that coming now? All right? Can you read me loud and clear at this point? You should be able to hear me reasonably clearly. Can you?
It's just buzzing.
Okay, let's see if we can.
Sounds like we're up at the waterfall.
Fix you up here. Well, we don't want that sound. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be working quite right. Maybe somebody from the tape ministry could.
What channel is that? Is that on channel 5?
I'm not sure. It says 5, but I'm really not sure exactly how this mechanism works here. But we had it working right yesterday.
That's right. Don't hold up the words.
All right. Okay.
Don't hold up the words.
I'll try to project nice and loud and clear for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, would you just take this into the tape ministry and see if they can solve the problem for us that it doesn't seem to be reading. The conversations are about his humorous poetry, which is fun because many, many, many of his poems can be given a twist that sounds funny to some of us, maybe not to all of us, but the surprise, which is the basic element of humor that is also an element in poetry, is often of a type that some of us at least will find a poem amusing. Come on in, and we've got some extra chairs up here. We'll just make chairs. Come on over, right, wherever you'd like to put it. We've got one more up here. I'll get this other one up here. Here's one more. Yeah, we talked a bit yesterday about the fact that surprise is the common element between poetry of all sorts and humor of all sorts. It's the surprise that makes the poem fun. It's surprise that makes the joke fun. You didn't expect the punchline to come out just as it did. And very good, fine. Now we should be hooked up fine. How's that reading now? Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Okay, now we're fixed up. Fine, thank you very much. That's great. I want to recommend the book, which most of the poems that I'll be talking about are in, which is the Louis Untermeyer anthology, and I recommend that you get it. It's available in the bookstore. That's a plug. And it's at the very reasonable price of $4.95, which even poor students like most of us are able to afford, right? Then there's another nice little book, which I referred to yesterday, which is also available in the bookstore, and this costs a new low price of 50 cents, which was put together by some folks at Holden Village some years back. This has also a group of 7 of Frost's most interesting poems with some very interesting commentary by some people who were talking about Frost here some years back. So I recommend that you pick up one or both of these if you're interested enough to do so. But it's by no means essential that you have any of the poems in front of you. Indeed, I'll talk a little bit about when I come to the point about how he worked. And I want to come to how he worked after we talk a bit more about his humorous poetry. Talking about the fact that he thought that we should always read poetry aloud. that we should always go from the sound of the words, and their meaning comes only secondary. It's the sound of the sense of the words, as he said. But concentrating on humor, he had, as I mentioned yesterday, a kind of wry Yankee style of humor, which is understated, often taciturn, often quizzical, and it's something that I remember well from having grown up in New England, having gone to college where he started going to college at Dartmouth, and he loved that kind of humor that the particularly northern New Englanders have as their favorite kind of expression. For example, he wrote a poem, a wonderful poem, long for him, called New Hampshire, in which he talks a lot about places in New Hampshire that I'm familiar with. It's discursive, it's a lovely poem, it is moderately critical of New Hampshire, he's got a critical eye, and the final lines of the poem, after talking for several hundred lines about New Hampshire, is as follows. Presently, I'm living in Vermont. That's his last line. That's his last line. Also, I like his wry humor in an exchange that he had with a student, a rather pompous young student, as students will occasionally be, not present people, but other students that I've dealt with occasionally are a little pompous, particularly if they've got a little bit of information and they're feeling pretty full of it, full of that information. Student said to him, a rather student-type question, "Well, surely, Mr. Frost," he said, "all art is useful only as it prompts to action. It must prompt to action in order to be useful." And Frost paused just a moment, and then he said, "Well, how soon?" That's one of his little twinkly jokes that the more you think about it, the better it gets. How soon? How soon? The boy, needless to say, it was a boy, didn't really come back very quickly from that one. Let's look at a couple of the poems that we had in the handout that we were talking about yesterday. And it's not necessary to have it in front of us, but there are a couple of them that I would like to have us take a look at. For example, page 3 in the handouts, right at the top of the page, there are a couple of these very nice short ones. The top of the page there, "The Secret Sits." Somebody have it in front of them who would like to share it with us, who would like to read it for us, so we get some sharing of the sound of the words? Do you want to read it for me, sir?
"We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows."
Yeah. Let me just give it to you one more time. So that was a nice reading. It's almost a New England style there. Are you a New Englander, sir?
Oh, no.
No? Minnesota. Minnesota. Well, there are some similarities. Minnesota's not New England, but Minnesota's okay also. "We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows." Two lines. So what's the secret, do you think? "We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows." What do you think the secret might be? I mean, it's obviously subject to our own interpretation, whatever we might happen to think that the secret would be in this poem. The
secret of life.
Yeah, the secret of life. Sure, the basic secret of life. Do you know what that is? No, I've been trying to figure it out too, yeah. In fact, we are, I think it's fair to say, we are seated in a ring and we're supposing, right? You and I. Touché. I have to confess that I don't know. If indeed you think I'm the secret, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to excuse yourself, because I wouldn't want to have you be disappointed. What else might the secret be?
Why is it capitalized?
Why is it capitalized? Good question. Why is the S in secret capitalized? It's the only word, except for the first letters of each line, which is indeed capitalized. Does that give us a clue as to what one interpretation of it might be?
It sounds like
God. Could be God, couldn't it? It's kind of a fresh, bold, smart alecky poem, if it indeed is about God. But Frost wasn't above that or below that. He might have been thinking about God. We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. He wasn't above tweaking God's ear in some of his poems. And I think this may be one. I'm sure there might be other interpretations. Anybody else think of something else the secret might be? Yes.
Well, maybe like we think we keep our secrets to ourselves, but people can really see them, or others can see them.
Aha.
Kind of do our dance of life.
Yeah. Yeah. The things that we are trying to keep secret, others can often perceive. Children, for example. Children perceive. I'm amazed when I discover, as I do periodically, things that my kids remember about me that I thought they had no idea about, right? Because they were little teeny kids when these things were developing. Kids are enormously perceptive, so maybe that could be part of it, that kids perceive things about us that we think are secret, but they're not. Maybe he's saying you can't keep secrets. We go along supposing that we are posing as successfully as dignified people, for example, whereas our kids know that we're not that dignified, really. Let's take a look at the next one down in this page, an answer. Somebody who had that one want to share it with us? Would you like to read it for us? Want to read it aloud for us? That second one?
But islands of the blessed, bless you, son. I never came upon a blessed one.
Two lines. I'll read it again, just again. That was a nice reading. I'll read it again just to get the give you a second crack at it. This is called an answer. But islands of the blessed, bless you, son. I never came across a blessed one. So what's that about? What is the island of the blessed, do you think, that he's referring to? Again, this is subject to a lot of different interpretations, it seems to me. But islands of the blessed, bless you, son. I never came across a blessed one. Why is it funny? Why did a number of folks were laughing? What do you think tweaked your funny bone about it?
I like the way that there are kind of two different meanings of blessed, and it's used three different times. And in the first part.
What are the two?
Well. A blessed person, like a holy, God-like person.
Mm-hmm.
And then a blessed one, like a darn one, a bloody one.
Blessed, the last blessed used as, but I never came across a single one, a darned one, nary a one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a third use of the word bless there that might have a, what would be the other interpretation? Maybe there are three.
Well, the bless you kind of.
Yeah. Bless you. What else might be used there instead of bless you?
My dear boy,
very good. I was thinking the Irish might say, and I'm of Irish descent, and I've spent some time in Ireland, the Irish might say, God love you, boy. Huh? God love you, son. Instead of bless you, God love you, son. No, I never came across a blessed one. Could be, right? So that's more a term of endearment, almost, isn't it? Bless you, son. So what is an island of the blessed here? Yes,
I feel
Phyllis.
Like I'm coming in on the middle of a conversation where a happened to youth is asking him, what are, or what is, or do you know, as if, of islands of the blessed, and that this is just a response.
Right, I couldn't agree more. Indeed, this is like spoken, a spoken exchange, isn't it? So, now picking up from that, what do you think, Phyllis, the island of the blessed might be? What do you think?
The Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Eden, a utopia. Yeah, very good. But islands of the blessed, bless you, son, I never came across the blessed one. I'm older than you are, son, and I've traveled around. Yes, sir, I've been around a lot. But, hey, there's some things I've never seen. I've never seen paradise. And I, well, except for Holden Village. Except Holden Village would, of course, be the exception here. But I've never come across, have you ever come across a place where everybody is really nice?
No, nope. I'm coming.
Everybody's sweet to everybody else all the time. Everybody is truly Christian in the best sense of Christian. Everybody is unselfish.
Not even at Holden Village.
Not even at Holden Village. That's heresy. I'm not even going to touch that. We're on tape, you know, here. I'm not going to touch that. I'm not going to touch it. Okay. That's certainly one place it could be. And the islands, are we talking here about literally islands? Islands in the sea?
No.
No. There might be islands in the sea. But they might be places such as Holden might be perceived, or a town might be perceived. A New England village might be perceived as an island cut off from every place else. But is it paradise? Is it where everyone is really kind to his neighbor, thinking of his neighbor first before himself or herself? Sir?
Could it be that he's speaking about individuals as islands of God?
Yeah.
Of the blessed.
Yeah, good. Good, yeah. Could be individuals. Yeah, right. No man is an island entire of himself, entire of itself, as John Donne's poem runs. No man is an island. We're all joined together. That's a slightly different thought, but it's picking up on your metaphor of the interpretation of the metaphor as being an individual. Yeah, that's good. You see, there are all kinds of interpretations here. And indeed, one of the fun things about Frost was people would say to him, oh, Mr. Frost, in that poem and answer, did you intend that blessed, that first blessed, could be an individual? And Frost was wont to say, no, I didn't put it in the poem, but if you find it there, it's yours. No extra charge. It's one of his responses. One of his responses. He had a lot, some stock, you can imagine, all the times he read and had people coming, and he was very welcoming to people coming up and talking with him afterward. As I mentioned, I used to be his escort when I was at Dartmouth working as assistant to the president, and I would be there while he was being so kind to people coming up. The only kind of question that he didn't necessarily answer with complete grace was when somebody would come up and say, Mr. Frost, I interpret this poem this way. Is that what you meant? Or did you actually mean it that way? And if the person were a little too pushy with that interpretation and wanting him to say yes, he would say, I've heard him say this several times, if I'd wanted you to know, I'd have told you in the poem. Just a little bit of a... If I wanted you to know, I'd have told you in the poem. We'll come to somewhere where I'll tell you that he said that to people after he gave them. Let's take a look at just one other of these in the handout. I like the Wright's biplane, the number two, page number two, the very top one there. The Wright's biplane is the name of it if you're looking it up in one of the books. Somebody have this, would like to share this one? Would you like to share that one with us, please?
This biplane is the shape of human flight. Its name might better be First Motor Kite. Its maker's name, time, cannot get that wrong, for it was writ in heaven doubly right.
Thank you. I'll give it to you again just so you get it. Get a second crack at it. The Wright's biplane. This biplane is the shape of human flight. Its name might better be First Motor Kite. Its maker's name, time cannot get that wrong, for it was writ in heaven, doubly Wright. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. Yeah, doubly Wright. Doubly Wright. So we've got the three rhymes, flight, kite, Wright. He saw the plane. He saw a replica of the plane and was struck with how flimsy it was. And he said, it really should be like a kite that's flown by kids rather than an actual airplane. And that's one of the things that prompted this poem. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, but it is striking how fragile it was. There are a couple of very good biographies of the Wright brothers, by the way, that have been written in the last 4 or 5 years. Two excellent ones, which I commend to you if they intrigue you. They're fascinating men. Of course, the same vintage as Frost in the sense that when they were first flying, he was graduating from high school. So he was very cognizant of them. But there I love that just double play, for it was writ in heaven, doubly Wright. Got to get the name right because we're given twice Wright. Wright, playing on the Wright brothers and the Wright name. Cannot get that wrong. Can't get their name wrong, can you? You got to get it right. That's what he's telling us. So he's not above a pun. The lowest form of humor, some people feel. he's not above it. No, he's not above anything like that if it suits his purposes. There are now a couple of others in the book that I'd like to have us take a look at. Let's take a look at Fire and Ice on page 242 in our Untermeyer book, which I think some of you have. Page 242. Somebody have the book? Who would be willing to read that for us? Would you like to read that for us? The title is Fire and Ice.
Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. For what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
Thank you so much. That's a nice reading. Let me try it one more time, too, so you get two cracks at it, those of you who don't have the book. And this is the way Frost would want us to have puzzled it out. He wouldn't necessarily want it to have us in front of have the poem in front of him parsing it. He would want us to hear it and react to it as hearing. He was always in favor of reading poetry aloud. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know of enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. What do you think about that? What do you think? Do you think the world's going to end in fire, or do you think the world's going to end in ice? Do you think the passion? We had a discussion in the forum last night about passion. Eros, out of control, desire, rampant, destroying because of its enormous power. And that comes closer than, we were talking about Venus last night, and Venus associated with Mars. Mars being war, Venus being love, but including erotic love, eros. Mars then standing for war, which is then, I think, associated also with fire, right? We get so impassioned at one another that we destroy each other. We've seen some of that in the last few months, haven't we? So that would be the way that we would interpret one possible ending of the world by fire. And then how about ice? Hate, cold, freezing, dispassionate, awful hatred. Not hot at all, but cold. Might that be the way the world will end, by hate?
I think he also might be referring with the ice to, I think when you think of a person ignoring, like whether it's the homeless or ignoring the ills of the world, that or even say within a marriage, when two people are just living in the same house and aren't relating to each other, that ignoring someone is almost much harder than some type of overt aggression.
It's not unrelated to hate,
right?
Is it? If we see and don't look, if we look and pass on.
And that's a cold, that's a cold feeling, yeah. If someone chooses to ignore you.
Yes. Yes, indeed it is. Indeed it is. If you've been ready to greet somebody and the person has looked away from you, there's a chill. There's a chill that one reacts to. Yeah, and multiplied by enough times, that could be hate in a destructive sense. So why, is this a funny poem? Is it funny? Does it strike any of you as funny? Is there any aspect of it that strikes you as funny? Sir?
To me, it kind of sounds like he's saying it really doesn't matter which one it is. Whether it's fire or whether it's ice, it's going to be the end. It's going to hurt anyone.
Yeah, yeah. And isn't it a little funny? Isn't it a little bit kind of academic, a little bit pedantic to say, but should it have to happen twice? Yeah. Now let's analyze this, shall we? Let's be factual about this. Let's just take it and parse it and see what we come up with. Yes, I think probably if it happened twice. Then there's another line that I'm following up on your line of reasoning that I think picks up that point exactly, and that is to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. That's such an understated thing, isn't it, to say it would suffice, ice would suffice to bring about the end of the world? Yes, indeed. Okay, now let's turn to the next question. We're talking about the end of the world, folks. I think it would suffice, yes. I think ice would also suffice, yes. Mm-hmm. I think it would, yeah. I think so, yes. As I think about it, as I consider it, yes, I think it would. Yes, now what were we talking about before? Yeah. So I think that's part of the humor. Here he's taking such a terribly significant event and is treating it in a way, tongue-in-cheek, I would suggest, in a way that a pedantic professor might be treating it. And Frost was very hard on pedantic professors. He was a member of the faculty at Dartmouth, as I think I mentioned yesterday, and he didn't get along awfully well with some of his fellow faculty members, fellow professors. He was pretty tough on them. He didn't suffer fools gladly. And among the professoriate, even at my college and his college, Dartmouth, I have to admit there are just a few folks who are a bit pompous. Yes, I have to admit. At the college where I am presently, of course, there aren't any. We don't have any there, no. There isn't a pompous ass in the lot. No, yeah, there is. There is one, yeah. No, actually, well, there are a few. Yes, there are a few. There are a few. There are a few. Let's take a look at page 210 in our book. This is a slightly longer one. I love his shorter poems, but some of them are a tad longer, give him a little more time to build up a little momentum. This is departmental. This is called departmental. Does anybody have the book who would like to share this one with us? Do you want to try that one for us? Yeah, it goes to the next page. So take your time with it, no hurry. It is long, but take your time and you'll enjoy reading it, I'm sure. And we'll enjoy more hearing it than we would just by reading it. It'll be much more fun.
An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet if he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race, one crossing with hurried tread the body of one of their dead, isn't given a moment's arrest, seems not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the house of the court. Then word goes forth informing, death's come to Jerry McCormick, our selfless forager Jerry. Will the special Janissary
whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people. Lay him in state on a sepal, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician, and taking formal position, with feelers calmly a twiddle, seizes the dead by the middle.
Most of his poems have more other than comic elements in them. This is one of those that is almost purely comic. It builds to the final lines, I think, to be fun for you and me. And yet, it's not pure comedy. It's not pure fun. I think he's also saying some other things. What might he be saying, for example, in addition to just telling us the story about Jerry McCormick, our selfless forager, Jerry? What else might he be saying here? Furlong.
Poking fun at how humans deal with death.
Yeah, poking fun at how humans deal with death. Yeah. What aspect of our dealing with death, for example?
Eulogy.
Pardon me?
The eulogy.
The eulogy? The eulogy, perhaps?
The whole ritual of death. From the time the individual dies until he's put in the ground, that whole process. The having to be embalmed, having to have a funeral home, and having to go to the mortuary to do the visit, having all those things.
Yeah. For some reason, as you talked, I flashed on a poem by Emily Dickinson, who was, by the way, a favorite of Robert Frost. When her first book of poetry came out in the 90s, in the 1890s, he bought it for his wife-to-be. He was in high school. They were co-valedictorians of their class at Lawrence High School in Massachusetts, and he bought that book for her. Somehow I love that thought. So she was a favorite of his, and she wrote a poem that makes me think of what you were commenting on. Maybe some of you know it. The bustle in a house, the morning after death, the solemnest of industries enacted upon earth, the sweeping up the heart and putting love away, we shall not want to use again until eternity. Commenting on the same paradox, she gets a lot more of the sentiment in there, particularly at the end, but the bustle in the house, you've got to clean things up, right? The person who has died, somebody was being treated before, if the death took place at home, as most deaths did, of course, in Frost's early years and in Dickinson's years. And therefore, there wasn't a whole bunch of activity that was engendered by the passing of the individual. What else might he be saying about that process? Roll on, and then our reader.
It's like you can't bury, no one can bury their own dead anymore. I mean, you gotta, you know, I don't know if it's illegal, probably is, but you have to go to a mortician, you have to get a priest, you have to find a church, you have to, you know, all these little things that you have to get in order.
You have to pick up a casket.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can't use a wooden box.
It is compartmentalized.
It's compartmentalized, right? And you're often those things you don't do yourself. Often the person most involved or persons most involved with it can't even deal with it because the death has affected them so. And therefore there are professional people who will take over and do these jobs for us, take these tasks on for us. And
eagerly.
Yes, for a price. And what they do then is compartmentalized, it's departmentalized. Departmental is the name of the poem. It is standardized, right? There is a procedure, as Verlin pointed out. You've got to get the forms for filled out correctly and report on the death and when it transpired. And there are officials who must come in and decide on the cause of death, etc. So it's all compartmentalized. And I don't know that he's just talking about how it happens at death. I shouldn't wonder that he's commenting more generally about the way we go about our affairs. That we in Holden Village. Hey, are we departmentalized here? Yeah, I mean, we are departmentalized, right? One person does such and such, one person does another such and such, and no, I really shouldn't do that because that's not my job, and if I do it, I'm going to mix somebody else up, and that's the way an organization really has to function, but it sometimes gets funny, doesn't it? It sometimes gets funny. Yes?
I think just that he says it's nobody else's affair, and I think that just distances us. Yeah. And just even how I deal with death, one person does this, and one person does this, and because... like, once we don't bury our own dead anymore, we're so distanced from it. I think that's why a lot of people have a hard time dealing with those things, because it's just taken out of their hands.
Yeah, yeah. You come across somebody who's dead, as an ant does, and the ant sees the dead and pays no attention, as far as the observer can perceive, but there must be some kind of communication. A form must have been filled out saying, Jerry's dead down at the corner of X and Y, therefore, we should set those things in motion to take care of him. But there's no sentiment associated with it at all. And it's all very cut and dried. And he didn't like things to be cut and dried. That's why he didn't like science. Frost was an anti-science person. He hated the way science was taking over the world. And he hated the way humanists and humanities disciplines were being shunted aside in curricula at universities and colleges. And science was becoming ever more important. This is one thing that he had very strong feelings about, and I shouldn't wonder, maybe there's a little barb or two in here respecting that as well. Let's see. Yeah, there's one that I want us to read. We were talking earlier about interpreting some poems as funny. We brought some up here that some folks didn't think were very funny, and others thought maybe had some humor. Let's take a look at the first one in our handout. Provide. Somebody like to read that for us? You want to read that for us? What, Mike?
Provide. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty at the shag. The picture pride of Hollywood, too many fall from great and good, for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for late disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with wanton friendship at your side than none at all. Provide.
Now, goodness gracious me, is that a funny poem? Well, some of us were laughing. It's a poem that makes the minimum case for morality. A minimum case for morality. It's a paean to selfishness. How can he possibly give us a paean of praise for selfishness? Is that what it is? Is that a fair interpretation? A paean of praise for selfishness? That's right off the top. It just occurs to me as one description of it. Shall I try it one more time so we can think about it a little bit? The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag. The picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on simply being true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide! Provide!
Well, at the beginning, it talks about how fame comes and goes, and that those who have fame will often lose it and be lower than others because they're used to having fame. And you agreed that they could, you know, have and supply when they're famous.
Yeah. So what should they do? So if you get, yeah, if you get rich and famous, then put a little money aside to pick up your words, buy a friend who will stay with you through thick and thin. Right? Yeah. It's a little cynical, isn't it? Would you do that, do you think?
I don't know.
It's hard to know. It's hard to know. Is anybody famous here? Who's planning to do that? Yeah, 15 minutes of fame is all we got. Andy Warhol said, we all have 15 minutes of fame. So, while you've got that 15 minutes of fame, you want to plan ahead for yours. Plan ahead for your 15 minutes of fame. Try to decide how you're going to handle it and how you're going to make the maximum out of it, right? Get some press releases out. Well, I won't tell you how to do it. I'm sure you all know how you should spend that 15 minutes. But you sure want to think about it and you sure want to make maximum use of those 15 minutes of fame. Right? And maybe we all of us have some money at one point in our lives. No, it hasn't happened to me yet. I'm still waiting. But I have hope that I'm going to have a lot of money at some point. That is more than to pay my monthly bills. And at that point, I really want to plan ahead for how I'm going to spend that money. So I'm thinking of, but would you be interested in being my friend, you know, through thick and thin? I've got should we talk after class? Okay, right, see? Already we're making a little contract here. He hasn't committed, and I haven't committed, but on the other hand, we're on our way down that slippery slope, right? To utterly cynical relationships. Well, why not? Hey, Robert Frost says it's okay. He's one of our wise poets. It's okay with me, sir.
My feeling is that what he's really saying was the storing up for after you're dead. He's saying, cynically, provide for when you're after you're dead, and rather than saying provide for when you're alive, or live your life.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Now, why do you think that's in there? How do you
Well, I'm hearing, is it the Old Testament verse, or the New Testament verse, or
yeah.
What is the store up
treasures.
Oh.
The rich man and the poor man store up treasures.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing, is that he's poking fun at those who provide for after the dead.
Yeah. And one way that I think we might be given a clue, that certainly is one interpretation you could put on this. This is a complicated poem. One interpretation, one support for that interpretation would be that it's so overstated.
Right.
I mean, really, the kind of thing where this is an absurd conversation we're having, right? No, I mean, we're kidding. I'll buy him. I'll buy his friendship, right? I've got maybe $150. You think that'd be enough? We'll talk about the price. But that kind of conversation, Pete's sake, do you really take that seriously? No, we can't take that seriously. And therefore, a couple of things happen. One is, this degree of cynicism is so exaggerated that, point number one, it brings out the moral which was put upon it, namely, he can't mean that. He's got to mean the opposite of that. What you really ought to do is think about what's going to happen after those tough last years. Think about your relationship to God, for example. The other thing that it seems to me happens with the poem, and why I'm taking it up under humor and not under ambiguity, I mentioned yesterday we're going to talk some poems up that we're going to talk about that I think are specifically ambiguous in a way that I'd like to talk with you about them. But I chose to talk about this one under humor because I think that it's so exaggerated that it's funny. We laughed at it, right? We laughed at it. So it's, and this is by way of saying that the catalogs, the categories in which I have tried to put his poems, one of them being humor, is very arbitrary and very unrealistic because, as a matter of fact, there is an element of humor, a kernel of humor in many of the poems, including some of those that I'm going to take up under Stoicism, where he talks about New England Stoic people who undergo horrendous hardships, and yet there is a New England twinkle in them that is, that could put them into the category of humor. So my categories are arbitrary. My standardization list could be itself criticized by a mind that would write a poem like Departmental, criticizing putting things in categories. Because you put things in categories and then you realize that, well, that doesn't really work that way. It's more complicated than that. It's not that simple. It's not that simple. I want to introduce our next subject for you. I want to just talk a little about how he worked, because that's what we're going to take up next, unless, I'd like to get into that, but I'm not wedded to getting into that, because I want to give you a chance to pick some poems, a poem or so that you would like to have us spend a bit of time with and see if we find some humor in it or if any other reason. As I've just finished saying that my catalog of categories is arbitrary. So are there any poems on here or in the books that somebody would like to have me read? Or have us read and have us share? Some that you don't want to have us finish up talking about Frost without getting to, at least while you're here? I guess not. Not seeing any. So fine. What I want to say the way he worked was, and I think you can maybe sense it in some of the poems that we've been talking about today, that he always thought that the lines of poetry should be like lines from speech. Indeed, they should be from speech. He said, I want to write poetry so that there's no line in any poem that I haven't heard spoken. That was his goal, because he said the best poetry is poetry that comes from spoken speech. And we instinctively learn, you and I, how to sound the words so that the meaning comes through because we've heard them spoken. The ear does it, which is one reason why I don't necessarily want you all to have copies, or I would have broken the Holden rule and have got copies for all of you. But we don't like to waste a lot of paper here, and I respect that. But in addition, you don't need it, particularly if you can read it a couple of times, and if you can read it yourself aloud, that's the best way to get it. So he thought that the speaking voice knows how to behave, and I was impressed, and I think maybe some of you were too, with how well these poems are read by the folks that I just picked out to ask to read. I mean, everybody. And most of you were reading it for the first time, I think. Not in every case, perhaps, but most of you were reading it for the first time, and yet you got it. You got it. You got the way the voice needed to sound in order to make the sense of the line. And that's because it's Robert Frost. That wouldn't be true of every poet that I could come in here and have you share with us. Because Frost made his lines so that you could, on a glance, see how they had to sound in order to make sense. So the speaking voice has got to know how to behave, how to posture, and he wrote a bunch of letters to a close friend of his named John Bartlett, and I came across these, and I was impressed with his thesis here, because it ties so well to the way I think poetry ought to be treated. He said that you ought to know how a line will sound if it is taken from actual speech. For example, you and I would all know how to say the following things. And he just picked these at random somewhat. No, that's not right. Not at random, but they sound at random. And sent these to his friend John Bartlett. This is in 1913. 1913, he writes to his friend John Bartlett, who was in Alaska at the time. And he says, we would know how the voice should behave in the following phrases. My father used to say, you're a liar. If a hen and a half lay an egg and a half, a long, long time ago, put it there, old man. Putting your hand out. I ain't going to hurt you, so you needn't be scared. And then, I love this one. Suppose Henry Horne says something offensive to a young lady named Rita when her brother Charles is by to protect her. Can you hear the two different tones in which she says their respective names? Henry Horne! Charles! I can hear it. This is Frost saying, writing to his friend. I can hear it better than I can say it. And by oral practice, I get further and further away from it. By oral practice, I get further and further away from it. In other words, it's the spontaneous. It's the spontaneity with which you say, Henry Horne, Charles. You say the two, that wasn't as good that time. That wasn't as good. That wasn't the way she would actually say it. Here are a couple more. Never you say a thing like that to a man. And such they are, and such they will be found. Well, I swan. Unless I'm greatly mistaken. Hence, with denial vain and coy excuse, a soldier and a feared. Come, child, come home. The thing for me to do is to get right out of here while I'm able. No other way you could say that. You couldn't say that any other way. No fool like an old fool. So he tried to make his poems such that you had to sound them in order to make the sense. So he always wanted them to be read aloud. He had great scorn, by the way, for what he said were the worst readers of all, and those are the fastest readers. Eye readers, we call them, you and I. I took a speed reading course, and I thought I was pretty hot stuff until I came across this language, and then I said, I realize it. Robert Frost wouldn't approve of this at all. I'm glad he didn't know that I had done this. But they're bad readers when you read with your eye because you miss the best part of what the good writer puts into his work, which is the way the sentences sound. He had a real scorn for these eye readers. He said that a real speed reader, you know what, he said the ultimate in a speed reader is a person who picks up a book and looks at the back of it and puts it down and says, I know you. I know you. Well, you don't have to go through all the exercise of going through them quickly, right? Just look at the back and say, I know you. That's all you need to do. That was his reference to how badly he thought people who read speedily, speed reading, actually treated the writers whom they should have respected more by paying some attention to the way the words ought to sound. So we'll talk some more about that next time. Thank you. Thank you.